This is Surgery IC Rounds. My name is Dr. Jeffrey Guy. We're picking up on a series on reviewing the Surviving Sepsis Guidelines. If you're picking up, this is the first podcast, Surviving Sepsis Campaign, International Guidelines for Management of Severe Sepsis and Septic Shock, 2008. This is revision of the 2004 guidelines, and this was published in the Journal of Intensive Care Medicine, as well as the Society of Critical Care Medicine's journal, Critical Care Medicine. And this was published back in January, volume 36, number 1, 2008. The first part of the podcast that we've already pushed out deal with some of the initial objectives to obtain in the first couple of hours, namely source control, obtaining cultures, IV antibiotics. And now we're going to pick up where we left off, and that's with fluid therapy. And the it's important to mention that the guidelines were not brought down, carved in stone from a mountain. This is the current best evidence. And the body of knowledge in critical care medicine changes at a rapid rate, such that what is a guideline today or best evidence today may be antiquated in just a very short period of time of, say, 12 or 24 months. It is also important that this is a consensus statement, which means that the thought leaders in critical care medicine regards to sepsis put together what they thought felt was the best document, but certainly there was not universal agreement. There has been some editorials, some of them rather scathing, that have criticized the Surviving Sepsis campaign. What's important to point out, though, is this is the best shot that we have, or the best attempt that anyone really, in my opinion, has done to try to collectively bring together the best practices, the best evidence of what we do to all the for the multifactorial problems that we encounter when we see a septic patient. So let's talk about fluid therapy. And the guidelines in regards to fluid therapy are not specific as to whether we should be using crystalloid or colloid. In fact, they recommend fluid resuscitation with either natural or artificial colloids, such things as Hespan or albumin, or crystalloids, because there is no evidence-based support for either type of one fluid over another, and that's a grade 1B recommendation. The rationale that they provide is that the SAFE study indicated that albumin administration was safe and equally effective as crystalloid. And the reference for that is the SAFE trial. The author is Finfer and colleagues, and that was published in New England Journal of Medicine 2004, volume 350, pages 2247 to 2256. Now, it's important that when you do look at the SAFE trial that there was a trend towards decreased mortality with the use of colloid in a subset analysis. And we're not going to go into all the potential problems that when we do subset analysis. But in a subset analysis of septic patients, there was a trend towards improvement, but it was not clinically significant. The p-value at that was at 0.09. Now, the one thing that they do point out is that the volume of distribution for crystalloids is significantly larger than that of colloids. Well, what does that mean? Well, we know that crystalloids having a larger volume of distribution, we've heard of the 3-to-1 rule, and perhaps in septic patients or patients who are very critically ill, it's absolutely perhaps 1-to-4. What that means is that if you give somebody 1 liter of normal saline or 1 liter of lactated ringers at 12 noon, how much of that stays intravascular at the end of an hour? Well, it's approximately 250 cc's, hence the 1-to-4 rule. Therefore, if you want to increase somebody's intravascular volume by, say, a liter, it's going to require 4 liters of crystalloid. And that's one of the things about colloids, is that colloids, because of they maintain oncotic pressure, they do eventually break down. The proteins are metabolized. Some would argue that, and the data is there certainly, that the albumin also goes extravascular, but it doesn't require as much volume to maintain the same increase in intravascular volume and hopefully increase of recruitable cardiac output. The other advantage, though, of crystalloids are significantly less expensive. Those of you who do volume resuscitation in the military, for instance, in forward positions or people who provide tactical pre-hospital care often will use artificial colloids or hypertonic fluids because of the smaller volume of distribution. Now, the Surviving Sepsis campaign recommends that fluid resuscitation initially target a central venous pressure of greater than 8 millimeters of mercury. And this is certainly an eye-raising recommendation because there's certainly a large cohort of people out there that feel that every person in an intensive care unit, if they're there for a psoriasis, gets a pulmonary artery catheter. Well, that's a provocative topic in itself. There isn't a lot of evidence to support that, but There is debate about what is the best way to assess end-diastolic volume or preload, and they're recommending central venous pressure. And that is by a group of thought leaders that are currently aware of all of the potential drawbacks of central venous pressures, but also they're also very aware of the drawbacks of pulmonary artery catheters. Now, central venous pressure greater than 8. However, if you are a mechanically ventilated patient, you should have a central venous pressure greater than 12. And the reason for that is that mechanical ventilation is a form of positive pressure ventilation that increases your intrathoracic pressure. And what that does is puts pressure on the pulmonary arteries, it puts pressure on the atria, it puts pressure on the vena cava, and that'll artificially elevate the central venous pressure. So if your patient is ventilated, the CVP should be greater than 12. And they talk about different types of fluid challenge techniques in the actual manuscript. Now, moving on to vasopressors, they recommend that the mean arterial pressure be maintained for a mean pressure of greater than 65 millimeters of mercury. And what's interesting is the way they approach this is I think that myself included as a resident, and I think many practicing intensivists would think, okay, well, when I get a patient who's in septic shock, they have this vasodilatation. So then they have a relative hypovolemia. They haven't lost, per se, a drop of fluid or dehydrated, but the container has gotten larger. They actually have lost some fluid because of some capillary leaks, but we're always of the mindset is fill the tank first, and then once we fill the tank, then step on the gas, and then filling the tank is the fluid resuscitation, and stepping on the gas is the use of vasopressors or inotropes. Well, what they write in the manuscript is that vasopressor therapy is required to sustain life and maintain perfusion in the face of life-threatening hypotension, even when hypovolemia has not yet been resolved. So what they're commenting is that the fluid resuscitation and the use of vasopressors are two things that happen in parallel. They're not saying that you use vasopressors in lieu of a fluid resuscitation, no, but you do those simultaneously. So as you're filling the tank, you end up using vasopressors to maintain an adequate mean pressure, such that the organs that are very flow dependent and very important to sustain life, such as the heart, brain, and kidney, receive adequate mean pressure so that they can continue their vital functions. Now, one of the inherent problems with a recommendation like this, where you put a number, mean arterial pressure greater than 65, is that all patients are different. You may have a patient who's chronically hypertensive. You know, they may have systolic pressures normally at home in the 180s. Therefore, what may appear to be normal tension in that patient may result in some profound decrease in organ perfusion. The same can be said for the young, healthy patient who perhaps is a marathon runner, typically lives with a pressure of 90 systolic. Therefore, that number could actually move upwards or downwards based on the baseline physiology of your patient. So you have to actually insert some thought process in this as well. But the key is start your fluid resuscitation. As you're resuscitating the patient, you can certainly go to vasopressors simultaneously. Now, what vasopressors should we consider? According to the surviving sepsis guidelines, the first line agents for augmenting the blood pressure and maintaining a mean pressure greater than 65 should be either norepinephrine or dopamine. They should be recommended through a central venous catheter as soon as one is available, obviously, because these are certainly life-sustaining vasopressors, but if these drugs, either one of them, infiltrate into the subcutaneous tissue, you have a very serious problem that will result in skin and soft tissue necrosis. They do suggest that epinephrine, phenylephrine, or vasopressin should not be administered as the initial vasopressors in the hypotensive patient with septic shock. They do go on to say that vasopressin at a dose of 0.03 units per minute may be added to norepinephrine subsequently with anticipation of an effect equivalent to that of norepinephrine alone. And they go back and they talk about some of the human and animal studies that look at norepinephrine and dopamine, why they would be particularly advantaged over epinephrine, and that epinephrine will result in significant tachycardia, as well as epinephrine causing significant splanchnic vasoconstriction, which can cause decreased perfusion of the mesentery, which may lead to hyperlactemia and certainly problems that go along with small vessels in the digits. Phenylephrine can decrease the stroke volume. There is no clinical evidence epinephrine results in worse outcomes, and it should be the first chosen alternative to dopamine or norepinephrine. So if you don't have dopamine or norepinephrine, they are recommending then that you go to epinephrine. Norepinephrine is more potent than dopamine and may be more effective in reversing hypotension in patients with septic shock. Dopamine may be particularly useful in patients with compromised systolic function, but it will cause more tachycardia and therefore be more arrhythmogenic than the norepinephrine. The recent VAST trial was a randomized controlled trial that compared norepinephrine alone to norepinephrine plus vasopressin. The dose in that trial was 0.03 units per minute. It showed no difference in outcome in the intent to treat group. One thing that is made very clear in the surviving sepsis guideline is the notion of low-dose renal range dopamine, something that was very popular in days gone by. We would give people who had any kind of shock, any kind of renal insult, oliguria, what have you, elevation of their creatinine, low-dose dopamine. And typically this was anywhere from 0.5 mics per kilogram per minute to about 5 mics per kilogram per minute. And the notion there was that dopamine acted through some sort of dopaminergic receptor to improve renal blood flow and hence was renal preserving, keeping people out of renal failure. Well, there's no evidence to support those notions. And what's interesting is the lesson to be learned here is there's a lot that we do that is practice-based or bias-based, but not particularly evidence-based. And this was something that was widely accepted in practice and in virtually every intensive care unit that I was ever in contact. I can't remember when the last time I ever used dopamine was. But the lesson to be learned there is that we have to be open to changes, that when there's no evidence to support that we're doing something, even though we've done it for 10 or 15 years, repetition of error is not experience. And they quote a large randomized trial and a meta-analysis that compared low-dose dopamine to placebo and found no difference in either primary outcomes, such as creatinine levels, need for renal replacement therapy, urine output, or time to recover normal renal function. Furthermore, there was no improvement in outcomes such as ICU or hospital discharge, hospital stay, and so forth. Certainly, those of us who have used renal range dopamine can say anecdotally, well, it seemed like our patients get better. Well, there could be several potential explanations for that. One is that when you give dopamine, some people consider it to be a natriuretic or a mild diuretic, and that will improve urine output. Furthermore, dopamine is a inotrope, and therefore you're improving cardiac output. That's improving renal perfusion, and dopamine also has alpha properties and will result in an increase in mean pressure, all which would be good for a perhaps injured kidney. Does that provide you any superiority over norepinephrine? It wouldn't appear so. And does that provide any credence that we're using dopaminergic receptors with the use of dopamine? And the answer to that is absolutely not. They also recommend that if you're using vasopressors, patients have an arterial line as soon as practical, and that is reasonable. It seems like a lot of patients are in intensive care units just because they're there, they get an arterial line. That's clearly not indicated, but patients who are on vasopressors, who are persistently hypotensive, and we're doing minute-to-minute management of their vasopressors, an arterial line is clearly indicated. Let's take a small timeout. We're back talking about surviving sepsis campaign, and we're now moving on to inotropic therapy. And there are situations where a patient may have a low cardiac index after being adequately resuscitated and elevation of their mean pressure. And when a patient does need an inotrope, the inotrope that's recommended is dobutamine. When patients have myocardial dysfunction, which would be suggested by elevated their cardiac filling pressures and a low cardiac output. They recommend against the use of increased cardiac index to predetermined supernormal levels. Where does that come from? Well, that comes from an era, again, where we actually use renal range dopamine, that we would take critically ill patients and we would push their oxygen delivery. We would insert PA catheters in essentially everyone, and using a lot of physiological calculations, we would take their delivery of oxygen and push it to supraphysiological levels. Well, what is the delivery of oxygen? Where do we obtain that from? Well, first of all, we end up calculating the content of arterial oxygen. And that was obtained by a formula. I mean, you can see this formula in textbooks, but you take the hemoglobin times 1.34 times the saturation of oxygen, and you would add that to the product of the PO2 times 0.0039. And it gave you basically the amount of oxygen in a deciliter of blood. Then we would take that number and multiply it by the cardiac output, and that was the delivery of oxygen. We would try to get that number to a supraphysiological level of 666. And then we would also try to take the oxygen consumption. We would be measuring that as well and calculating that, not measuring that, and we would try to get that to at least 166. The idea there was is that if a organ or the patient was what we called flow-dependent oxygen delivery, we needed to improve the delivery of oxygen. It was done widely in a lot of intensive care units. It was considered state-of-the-art when we did it, but there really hasn't been evidence to support its continued practice. In fact, in the manuscript, they say two large prospective clinical trials that included critically ill ICU patients who had severe sepsis failed to demonstrate benefit from increasing oxygen delivery to supernormal targets by the use of dobutamine in these supraphysiological oxygen delivery strategies. What is their position on the use of corticosteroids? I think this was also intriguing, and I think it's very, very practical. And the guidelines suggest that IV hydrocortisone, low-dose hydrocortisone, be given only to adult septic patients after it has been confirmed that their blood pressure is poorly responsive to fluid resuscitation and vasopressor therapy. So put another way, volume resuscitate them, give them your vasopressors, despite fluid resuscitation, despite vasopressor resuscitation, the patient is failing to respond, or what we would call in refractory shock. They go on to explain that one French multi-center randomized controlled trial of patients in vasopressor unresponsive septic shock showed a significant shock reversal and a reduction of mortality rate in patients with relative adrenal insufficiency. And they actually go on to define it using a ACTH stim fail of less than 9. This is the anon study. Two additional smaller randomized controlled trials also showed significant effects on shock reversal with steroid therapy. Now, we have talked about the Corticus trial in previous podcasts, and they do comment on that a recent large European multi-centered trial, Corticus, failed to show a mortality benefit with steroid therapy for septic shock. So you're not saving any more lives, but again, as we mentioned in the Corticus podcast, that it did show a faster resolution of septic shock in patients who did receive steroids. So, you know, if we're trying to get that mean arterial pressure up above 65 and we're giving fluids and we're giving colloid or we're giving vasopressors and we're adding our second line vasopressors of epinephrine or vasopressin and we're still not coming up, the Corticus data, even though it didn't show an improvement in life, live, die, i.e. mortality, it did show that you were able to get these patients out of shock more quickly. Now, although corticosteroids do appear to promote shock reversal, the lack of clear improvement in mortality coupled with known side effects of steroids such as increased risk of infection, myopathy, tempered the enthusiasm for their broad use. Now, here's what's interesting, and this goes back to the point that these guidelines are not brought down from a mountain, that these decisions that were fought out and argued by men and women who are considered thought leaders in critical care or critically care of the septic patient. And it says there was considerable discussion and consideration by the committee on the option encourage use in those patients whose blood pressure is unresponsive to fluids and vasopressors, while strongly discouraging use in subjects whose shock responded well to fluids and vasopressors. So what they're saying is that they weren't even on agreement to use in the hypotensive patient that was refractory, but they clearly say that if a patient is responding, their blood pressure is normalizing with the vasopressors and with the fluids, do not give. And they go on to discuss how they remediate, or how that not remediate, but how they reconcile their differences on the committee. Now, here's what's interesting. They suggest that the ACTH stimulation test not be used to identify the subset of adults with septic shock who should receive hydrocortisone. Okay. That did not be used. This is fascinating. They say that one study, this is the anon study, suggested that those who did not respond to ACTH with a brisk surge in cortisol, and that's a failure to achieve a greater than 9 microgram per deciliter increase in cortisol, were more likely to benefit from steroids than those who did not respond. The overall trial population appeared to benefit regardless of ACTH result, and the observation of potential interaction between steroid use and ACTH tests was not statistically significant. And they go on, and this is something that we're always kind of talking to our residents about. There was no evidence of the distinction between responders and non-responders in a recent multi-center trial. Commonly used cortisol immunoassays measure total cortisol, both protein and free, while free cortisol is the pertinent measurement. So we're not even measuring what we want to. The example that we often make on rounds is that if somebody is hypoalbumic and hypocalcemic, we say, do you want to give the patient calcium? And even the junior medical student knows that you have to correct the calcium for the hypoalbuminemia, because you may be giving calcium to a patient who doesn't need it. Well, cortisol is protein bound, much like is the calcium. And when you have a low cortisol, it may not be the fact that you have a low total cortisol or low free cortisol. It may be the fact that you have a low protein or low albumin. The authors go on to say the relationship between free and total cortisol varies with serum protein concentration. When compared with a reference method, mass spectrometry, cortisol immunoassays may over or underestimate the actual cortisol level, affecting the assignment of patients to responders or non-responders. So their point is, if the patient's physiology doesn't support it, then why even get the test? And I think that's just very common sense, and I applaud them actually writing that down, because this is something that I see all kinds of arguments break out in intensive care units and diversion among practitioners. Here is something that goes on, because most of our patients who come in intubated in the field or certainly in the emergency department have received etomidate. It says, the clinical significance is not clear. It is now recognized that etomidate, when used for induction of intubation, will suppress the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. Okay, so again, a lot of these patients who come in, they are intubated. Again, how do you interpret that in the face of somebody who has recently given etomidate? Here's something else that's certainly changing my practice, is they suggest that septic patients should not receive dexamethasone if hydrocortisone is not available. Well, why would somebody give somebody dexamethasone? The reasons are that dexamethasone will not interfere with a cortisone stimulation test. Therefore, if you have a patient who seems like they're failing to respond, you can give the dexamethasone and then still do a cortisol stimulation test. And since they're no longer recommending the cortisol stimulation test, then there's no reason to hold back and give the dexamethasone. Furthermore, dexamethasone can lead to immediate and prolonged suppression of the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis after administration. What do we do as far as the mineral corticoids? They suggest the addition of oral fluticortisone at a dose of 50 mics. If hydrocortisone is not available and a steroid that is substituted has no significant mineral corticoid activity. If you're using hydrocortisone, it does have mineral corticoid activity. And you can give the fluticortisone or not. It's considered optional. One study added 50 mics of fluticortisone orally. Since hydrocortisone has intrinsic mineral corticoid activity, there is controversy as whether fluticortisone should be added or not. Now keep in mind, the word there is controversy, so it means there's no clear answer one way or another. And they suggest that clinicians wean the patients from steroid therapy when vasopressors are no longer required. Let's take another brief timeout. We're back, and we're going to be talking about recombinant human activated protein C. This is Zagreus, and this element has actually resulted in some controversy with these guidelines. There was an editorial in the New England Journal of Medicine that really scathed, and that was somewhat unfair, the relationship of industry with these guidelines. And the editorial implied that the some of the drug companies, which I'm not a huge fan of drug companies' interactions with physicians, but the drug companies tainted the development of these guidelines. And in reality, the relationship with these guidelines is that they are actually helped with the dissemination of these guidelines. These guidelines and these recommendations of care are important. And I've said before that my opinion is that if you're within 50 feet of a septic patient in an intensive care unit, you need to be aware of what these guidelines are. You may not agree with them, but you certainly should be aware, because this does represent best practice. Recombinant human activated protein C, this is the drug Zagreus. I almost feel like I need to grab my wallet just to say it, but we do use it in select patients, and I think by looking at the guidelines, I think we're using it in the right patients. The guidelines suggest that adult patients with sepsis-induced organ dysfunction associated with a clinical assessment of high risk of death, That's a key word. High risk of death, most of whom will have an Apache score. Apache 2 score of greater than 25, greater than or equal to, multiple organ failure should receive recombinant human activated protein C if there are no contraindications. And I don't want to go into the contraindications. Zygris can potentially make you bleed. You need to know when you can give it to a post-op patient and so forth. But the key there is high risk of death and an Apache 2 score of greater than or equal to 25. If you don't know how to do an Apache 2 score, that's something for another day, or you can look that up. We recommend that adult patients with severe sepsis and low risk of death, most of whom will have an Apache score of less than 20 of organ failure, do not receive the recombinant human activated protein C. And they go through the prowess trial and the address trial and so forth. But those are key variables. High risk of death. We actually participated in the address trial, and the thought process of that study was that if we give Zygris earlier to a patient before they get so critically ill that we may see an improvement in outcomes. The data did not demonstrate that. The address trial had 2,600 patients in it, and judged to have a low risk of death at the time of enrollment. The 28 mortality rate for all causes was 17% on the placebo and 18.5% for the recombinant activated protein C. So there was no benefit in using it in less sick patients. Blood product administration, what it should be a quote transfusion trigger. We've talked about this in other podcasts about, you know, what's the data. It's fair to say that we should, in practice, should not have a threshold. We should judge everyone based on their physiology. Lena DiPolitano has done several great talks and written a lot about what the transfusion triggers are. And it's interesting when you hear her talk, she'll say, you know, the patient's not short of breath or chest pain, they're physiologically okay. And that's kind of about where I come down. But you've got to provide some sort of guidance with a number. And the guidelines say that once tissue hyperfusion has resolved in the absence of extenuating circumstances such as myocardial ischemia, severe hypoxia, hemorrhage, cyanotic heart disease, or lactic acidosis, they recommend that red blood cell transfusions occur when hemoglobin decreases to less than 7 grams per deciliter. And they say that you should target a hemoglobin of 7 to 9 in adults. Now, this is between 7 and 9. So if you're less than 7, if you're at 6.8, you don't need to give the patient 2 units of blood. According to the guidelines, you just need to get above 7, perhaps 7 and 9. They go on to say that although the optimum hemoglobin for patients with severe sepsis has not been specifically investigated, the transfusion requirements in critical care trial suggest that the hemoglobin between 7 and 9 grams per deciliter, when compared with 10 to 12 grams, was not associated with increased mortality in adults. Red blood cell transfusions in septic patients increase oxygen delivery, but does not usually increase oxygen consumption. Now, there's a lot of reasons for that. We could spend an hour talking about that, but you have to keep in mind that the blood that you are giving from a blood bank is not normal blood, and therefore it does not respond to normal blood. Even though you may mathematically be increasing the hemoglobin concentration, you may be mathematically increasing the oxygen delivery, that blood is not normal. It won't perfuse through the capillaries the same. It will not release oxygen the same, and therefore should not be considered equivalent. When it goes to erythropoietin, they recommend that erythropoietin not be used as specific treatment for anemia associated with severe sepsis, but may be used when septic patients have other accepted reasons for administration of erythropoietin, such as renal failure. Clinical trials in critically ill patients show some decrease in red cell transfusion requirements, but it has no effect on clinical outcome, particularly when it regards to the cost. But no difference in outcomes in patients who received erythropoietin and not. Therefore, the guidelines don't recommend it. Using fresh frozen plasma as a resuscitative fluid, they suggest that FFP not be used to correct laboratory clotting FFP not be used to correct laboratory clotting abnormalities in the absence of bleeding or a planned invasive procedure. So just because somebody's coags are out, you should not be giving them plasma. Platelets, and this is something that I think is interesting because I think that people's thresholds for platelet transfusions are higher than they actually should be, or higher than they're merited by the data. And it says, patients with severe sepsis, we suggest that platelets be administered when counts are less than 5,000, regardless of apparent bleeding. Platelet transfusions may be considered when counts are between 5,000 and 30,000, and there's a significant risk of bleeding. Higher platelet counts, greater than 50, are typically required for surgery or invasive procedures. They give the rationale, and part of it, I wonder how much the blood bankers are involved. But these numbers, these thresholds, I think most practitioners have these thresholds higher than what the data would support. Lastly, I want to talk about the issue of glucose control. There are other things such as DVT and bicarbonate therapy and stress ulcer prophylaxis in regards to the Surviving Sepsis campaign. But glucose control, and it's something that you can't open a journal of trauma or a critical care journal and not see something written about it. The Surviving Sepsis campaign that patients with severe sepsis who are admitted to the ICU receive IV insulin therapy, reduced blood glucose. And this is something that they don't want you to do typically within the first 6 hours, but after you get out of the first 6 hours, something you need to focus on. That first 6 hours, they really want it for source control, getting the antibiotics going, and trying to get the patient back to some sort of cardiovascular stability. They suggest a validated protocol, that typically means something that's been studied and perhaps peer-reviewed, for insulin dosing adjustments and targeting glucose levels to less than 150 milligrams per deciliter. The Society of Critical Care Medicine and Aspen both have working groups to try to figure out what is the target blood sugar, and they have not agreed. Right now, they're looking at blood sugars of less than 150. Blood glucose values be monitored every 1 to 2 hours till glucose values and insulin infusion rates are stable, and then every 4 hours. They recommend that low glucose levels be obtained with point-of-care testing of capillary blood be interpreted with caution, as measurements may overestimate the arterial blood or plasma glucose values. And we did recently an entire podcast on this. So again, if you're using point-of-care testing and your blood sugars are on the low range, this needs to be viewed with great caution and trepidation because these devices simply are not accurate. Keep in mind, the glucometers we're using at the bedside of the critically ill patients is a device that was designed for outpatient diabetes management. They go on and they talk about all of the studies regarding glucose control and improved outcomes in cardiac surgical patients, but then we get down to the issues of hypoglycemia and so forth, and they say two additional multi-center randomized controlled trials of intensive insulin therapy, one focusing on patients with severe sepsis, that's the VICEP, and a second on medical and surgical ICU patients, failed to demonstrate improvement in mortality, but these are not yet published yet. Both were stopped earlier than planned because of high rates of hypoglycemia and adverse events in the intensive insulin groups. A large randomized control trial that is planned to compare the 80-110 group to, say, 140-180 and recruit some 6,000 patients. This is the NICE Sugar trial, and it's ongoing, and I'm not sure when they're going to start reporting data. I heard someone say we'll probably see some interval data perhaps in the fall. I have no firsthand knowledge of that. Going back to the issues of blood sugar management, several factors may affect the accuracy and reproducibility of point-of-care testing of blood glucose. Capillary blood glucose levels, including the type and model of the device, the user experience, patient factors such as states of hypoperfusion or ischemia or hypotension, hematocrit, which can cause a false elevation with anemia, somebody who's PaO2, and various commonly used drugs. One report showed overestimation of arterial plasma glucose values by capillary point-of-care testing sufficient to result in different protocol-specified insulin dose titration. This disagreement between protocol-recommended insulin dose was largest when glucose values were in the low range. So again, you need to use those devices with great trepidation, particularly when we're on the lower range. And it's because of these hypoglycemic episodes that people are wondering about the 80-110 versus, say, 80-150 or even something higher. And again, we've talked about that in a previous podcast. That includes our review of the Surviving Sepsis campaign. You can find this in Critical Care Medicine, the January edition. And again, I think you should be familiar with it if you're taking care of some sick and critically ill patients. You've been listening to the podcast, ICU Rounds. My name is Jeff Guy. We thank you for downloading and hope you keep downloading and listening to us. Thank you and goodbye.